Well, welcome along to the Pastor's Heart. My name is Dominic Steele, and it's great that you can join us. Now, today, our topic is how to preach 1 Corinthians chapter 11 well. A couple of months ago, we had Simon Manchester on as a guest, and we were talking to him about the whole area of how do you preach the cross and the resurrection well at Easter time. Well, this week, in our church, Village Church, Annandale in Sydney, we've been working through 1 Corinthians, and we hit 1 Corinthians chapter 11. And I last taught on the passage when we were last going through the book back in 2008, but the cultural climate and the biblical worldview seem even further apart now than they did a decade ago. And I think amongst Reformed evangelical complementarians, there's a nervousness about tackling really any of the New Testament gender passages, but particularly 1 Corinthians 11, where the topic of head is discussed. And that's even more so because we want to do the right thing, we want to be caring, we want to be loving, particularly to women, particularly to women who've been victims of domestic violence, and make sure that we are sending a really clear message on that issue. Now, some have chosen to avoid chapter 11 of 1 Corinthians. Some have chosen to avoid 1 Corinthians altogether. Should we do that? I say no. I asked a few weeks ago on a minister's Facebook group for friends to recommend to me sermons where they felt the passage had been really well done, both exegetically and applying it to the culture today. And I was pretty disappointed that I didn't get that many recommendations of somebody who's just taught on a Sunday on this passage, and it's up on the sermon archive of the church, and so you could go to it and see what they've done. It is, as a passage, so widely discussed in theological literature. I'd even make the claim it's probably one of the most discussed passages in theological literature in, say, the last 20 years, but it is so little preached about. So I've asked a couple of friends to come in and help me with my sermon preparation, and I'm really pleased to welcome to the Pastor's Heart Dr. Lionel Windsor, New Testament lecturer from Moore Theological College, and Danny Troik, old friend, and Danny's been on the staff at St. Matthias Centennial Park for 7 years. She's now doing a PhD on singleness, and she's actually the driving force behind the single-minded conference that's coming up later in the year, which is going to be super helpful to so many people. So, Danny, Lionel, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, great to be here.
Tell us, what are the issues that we face when we come to this passage? And I'm guessing there's culture and text. Danny, why don't you start on the culture? What are the issues?
Well, yeah. I think you've already spoken about it in one sense, that any text, biblical text that talks about men and women, relationships between them in our culture, is bound to be one that causes some degree of controversy, and it's a lot of emotions for a lot of people that are caught up in that. As you said, I think in recent years, the right and proper attention that is being paid to survivors of domestic violence and how passages like this interact with that topic is one that really does mean that it is a difficult topic to come to and think about carefully and then apply it well. Also, with most of the biblical passages about men and women, this balance between talking about our equality as people made in the image of God, that ontological essence that we have as being equal, but a functional differentiation in role is one that it is really hard to work out how to speak about. And in our culture, just that separation doesn't exist. The two are the same thing. So how do we as Christians
approach... Because the Bible clearly teaches it.
Well, the Bible teaches it, that's right. But it's a very difficult thing in our culture to accept and understand and speak about in a meaningful way.
To the text, Lionel.
Oh, to the text. I'd love to be able to say that I could hold it all in my head, all the issues, but I can't. There's so many of them just in terms of questions. So
I'm nervous because of the culture, and I'm nervous because of the text.
The text as well, that's right, exactly. So I've had to write it out. I've done the normal thing that you do when you, well, that you should do, at least now, teach my students to do.
Give us a look here. I'll just hold this up. This is, I felt so encouraged to, this is your flow diagram that you've done, and your notes on the passage.
I
did a flow diagram the other day working through it, and when we finish this, I'm going to take this home and see and compare my answers with the New Testament lecturer.
Give mine back, though. I want to keep those notes. But I wrote down, so, I mean, just in terms of the questions, the issues, you know, so there's questions like, what is the head? What does it mean? Is it source or theory?
Okay, so head, source, yeah.
Head, what is this idea of head? Mm-hmm. Secondly, what is prophecy? Mm-hmm. I think we know what prayer is, maybe. What is prophecy? What is the covering being talked about? What's the thing about glory, especially in verse 7? Mm-hmm. What about authority in verse 10? Whose authority? The woman's authority or the man's authority? Mm-hmm. What on earth are the angels doing in verse 10? Where do they come from? And then the question about nature. What's the nature is teaching something. So what is nature and what exactly is it teaching? And I want to add another one as well. That often it's not actually an issue that is seen as an issue, but it's actually the question of what is the overall situation going on here. Many people assume that this is public worship or something, and we kind of make
we kind of all assume that. And then Tony Payne just wrote that off the other day. So I've chased him up the last couple of weeks because he's doing his PhD on stuff related
to this. That's right. And it's partly got to do with the fact that it is not actually said in the text precisely what the situation is. We just assume from some of the things in the context.
I've got one more for you.
Another one.
Is it about men and women? Is it about husbands and wives?
That's right.
That's another important one.
Exactly. I forgot to write
just
that
because we didn't have enough already.
That's right. Exactly.
So just 10 extra.
So we're going to solve them all.
That's right.
Okay, key principles in approaching this passage. What are we looking for?
So what we need to be doing, it's really true when we approach any passage, but it just becomes obvious here, or just very, very important here, that what we need to be doing is preaching from and applying from what is clear and what is taught by the text, and preaching with the grain of the text and what is there, rather than preaching from a possible reconstruction. And that can really we can easily do that, because we can get so caught up in trying to reconstruct precisely what was going on that we spend all of our time doing that. And we forget that there are some clear things.
In fact, one of the commentaries I was reading, he kind of jumped past what I thought was clear and sort of said, and jumped into all these debate issues and then did a reconstruction on the way through that I thought kind of went against what I thought was the plain meaning of the text.
Look, I'm a New Testament scholar, and I just feel so guilty for my whole profession, that's what we're constantly doing. We're constantly focusing people on possible reconstructions rather than on the actual text. And I want to not do that. I want to say, no, there is something clear in here. So that's the first principle.
Other principles?
Another really key principle is we need to love what it says. That's again, easy in some passages and harder in others. This passage is, as we look at it, we need to not just love what it says, learn to love what it says. It's about learning. It's about trying to come to grips with what is being said and saying, this is from our loving Heavenly Father, and this is good. And how can I learn to love it rather than try to get around it?
Rather than making excuses for the text, I've got to be saying,
yes,
my dad wants my good.
Exactly. That's right. And that can be hard. And as a man, as I read this, I read verse 3 and my reaction is, I'm afraid. And the reason that I'm afraid is because I go, well, if this is true and if I try to teach it, I'll be causing problems. I'll be causing domestic violence, or I'll be causing things I don't want to cause. And so I'm tempted to think this is a bad text. This is a bad word from God, whereas it's a good one.
Why don't I read the key verse and then I'll ask you guys what it means.
No problem.
I'm just going to start. 1 Corinthians 11, verse 2. I'm in the Holman. I don't know if that's the translation, but anyway, I'll do that one.
I've got the Greek.
Now,
I'm not trying to say.
Oh, you show off.
I'm allowed to. There's a lot of things I can't do. I'm supposed to. It's my job.
Now, I praise you because you remember me in all things and keep the traditions just as I delivered them to you. But I want you to know that Christ is the head of every man, and the man is the head of the woman, and God is the head of Christ. So what's it mean? Let's start with you, Danny.
Oh, let's start with me. Thanks for throwing me in the deep end. Well, I think it means what it says. Of course, what it says is actually a really tricky question, isn't it? I think that what we see here is that there is some sense of order in relationships that's been built into creation of man and woman, mm-hmm. that we see modelled in the Trinity, and the way that the Trinity actually relates to each other. And so what we see, I think, is Paul calling both men and women to emulate Christ in the way that he responds in relationship. Mm-hmm. The man as the head, as Christ is the head of man, and the woman as Christ submits to the Father as his head. So broadly speaking, big brushstrokes, I think that's where it's going, yeah.
And I really want to affirm that, especially in you need to dwell on this. And I feel like in terms of preaching it,
how do I preach it? Yeah.
Actually dwelling on the structure of it is because we can kind of skate over it, mm-hmm. and think, okay, there's a hierarchical structure going on here: God, Christ, man, woman. That's what's being taught here, mm-hmm. and that is there, but the way that the text is structured actually points us to precisely what Danny was saying, and that is Christ is the model for the man, mm-hmm. and Christ is the model for the woman. Mm-hmm.
So if I want to learn how to be a man, what should I do?
If you want to know how to be a man in relation to a woman, look at how Christ relates to me.
Okay.
Sacrificially,
yeah.
In love, in service, and in that love that is spelt out.
That emptying himself, that putting interests others first, that laying down his life.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, there's no place in complementarianism for the domestic violence. Do you know, there's no place in complementarianism. We just want to make this point clear.
Really, absolutely clear.
There's no place in complementarian theology for selfishness, for putting myself first.
Yes.
If I am to be a Christian man, I'm about laying down my life for my wife.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's right. And this is slightly beyond, but I just want to say it. It extends to our attitudes as well, and our internal attitudes. That's actually what Ephesians 5 is about. Ephesians 5 speaks against that attitude of literally misogyny. Our attitudes, there's no place even for an internal attitude of superiority or despising, it is about love and service in actions and in attitudes.
Yeah, that's right.
So for me, I think it's pointing me to that verse, to something like Philippians 2, where Christ empties himself, makes himself nothing, takes on the very nature of a servant. When he does that, I think that's how I'm to be the husband. How does somebody be a woman?
Well, again, in relationship to men, and in this passage, and again, we haven't nailed down if it is all men and women, if it's husbands and wives. It's a bit of both.
Well, what
so,
is
you
it?
Know. Stop asking me the hard questions. But I just want to echo what Lionel was saying, that for me as a woman, it means modelling, imitating Christ, who willingly, and I think in a sense sacrificially, submits to the Father. It's, you know, it's...
Now, where do you get that from?
Where do I get what from?
Christ submitting to the Father.
Well, I'm talking about the headship, that God is the head of Christ.
Mm-hmm, yep.
So in this passage, that's what we're seeing there. So that's the model, I think, that is there for men, as Lionel said, but also for women. Mm-hmm. This passage actually helps me as a woman to understand what it is to be more like Christ. And it urges me and gives me a pattern to exercise that in the context of my relationship with men, particularly in the home and the church.
Let me just say there are various tricky Trinitarian things going on here, and so there is the question of, you know, when you say submission, you need to, you know, to say that we mean it in the sense of the sacrificial death of Jesus Christ and not in ontological terms.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, and I think that's something that is really, again, I spoke about this a bit earlier, in our culture, the idea that you can actually submit or sit under someone's authority willingly without seeing your sense of self and identity diminished. Our culture doesn't understand that. Though I think we do. I was reflecting this just the other day, actually. I'm not a mother. I'm single. I've got a wonderful little one-year-old nephew. His sister is my nephew's mother. She is the one who is in authority in the way that I relate to my nephew. I don't give him food that she says don't give him. You know, I submit to her authority.
And the Lord Jesus does it in the Garden of Gethsemane.
That's right. That's right.
He has a preference about which way to go.
That's right.
But he says, not my will, but your will be done.
Yeah.
So.
But that doesn't necessarily equate with any sort of diminishment of myself as a person and my dignity and inherent sense of identity. I don't think of myself as any less than my sister because in that role and relationship, I submit to her authority in that context. You know, so I think we do it in all sorts of ways in our lives and our relationships. But when it comes to the men and women issue, it rears its ugly head and we find it very difficult to wrestle with.
Okay, let's now go through some of those issues that you spoke about.
Yes, indeed.
So we've done the... Well, actually, have we really? Men, women, wives, husbands.
I think as I read it and read it in detail, Paul appears to be drawing out a principle that relates particularly to wives and husbands because of the going back to creation. Mm-hmm. You've got the man and the woman in the garden. Mm-hmm. Yet at the same time, the principle appears to be applicable to a wider relationship than men and women. Mm-hmm. But I want to be careful there.
A wider relationship.
So between husbands and wives, right. I'm sorry. I want to be careful there. The reason that I think that is because Paul has in mind, you know, single people, mm-hmm. 1 Corinthians chapter 7. And it's an argument for men and women to relate to one another. Mm-hmm. At the same time, there does seem to be, as you go through, it appears to be a particular application that would be particularly applicable in this context to husbands and wives.
Sure.
I think. However, people argue about that. So that's just me right now, and I might change my mind.
We've only got a few minutes. I'm just hanging through these. Yep. Head or sauce, Denny?
This is one of the key issues in the passage. And Lionel probably might want to weigh on this a bit too, but I think from looking at the evidence of how you translate the Greek word for head there, there is far more exegetical evidence through the scriptures that it ought to be authority, and Lionel can weigh in on what that might actually mean, as opposed to source. You will often hear it presented that source is a very credible and very appropriate translation of the word head here. But when you actually go and look at the evidence, there's very, very little evidence, and there's very, very...
There's actually no
unambiguous biblical evidence that that is an appropriate definition, and it actually goes back mainly to some ancient Greek, a couple of ancient Greek texts, which could be translated in that way. And when you look at the lexicons that specialise in New Testament, the New Testament era, none of them give the source as a possible translation. Mm-hmm. The best person, I think the best article I've read on this is by Wayne Grudem. Mm-hmm. He has done a very extensive response to a whole lot of the arguments that source is the right translation here in Recovering Biblical Manhood and Womanhood.
We'll get the reference to that. We're putting it up on the screen now, and we will put it in the footnotes of the article on thepastorsheart.net if you want to.
You're going to do a deep dive.
Yeah. Okay, prophecy.
Well, I'd like to keep coming back to the head question. I think, and Danny's quite right, that's a helpful article in putting to rest really the idea of source, and source really doesn't make sense. The alternative is given as authority. Mm. I think we just have to be very careful when we describe exactly what that means. What does authority actually mean? So we say, there's two alternatives. It's either source or authority. The problem is, if we use the word authority in our world, and this is important mm-hmm. in preaching, mm-hmm. Then automatically what people hear is, well, who has authority in our world? CEOs of companies, mm. my boss.
You can tell me what to do.
You can tell me what to do, the people who make the decision. So authority is actually seen in terms of decision and leadership and all that kind of thing. Mm. However, looking at the text here, there's nothing directly about decision making. There's nothing directly about what we might call leadership. There's nothing about being the CEO of a company. But what is in this text quite a lot is honour and shame. That's where mm-hmm. what Paul keeps coming back to, honour or glory mm-hmm. and shame. Mm. We care about who makes the decision. It's about honouring, so a woman honouring her husband.
Okay, we've got to get our roller skates on. Okay. We've only got a few more minutes. Got it, yep. Covering?
Well, look, if we can just keep talking about the other things, we don't need to worry about what that means.
So here's the question.
Yeah.
As I'm translating it, I can't work out whether it's about wearing hats or having long hair. What's going on, Mr. New Testament scholar?
I want to try and answer that question, but I also want to say, and I want to remind us, and this is not sort of trying to
I mean,
to
I
get
have
out
a
of
slight
it.
Hunch myself, yeah. but I'm interested in your
exactly.
one.
This is not trying to get out of it, but I just want to remind everyone that actually, if you got verse 3, then you just then watch what Paul is doing with the rest of it, and you don't necessarily need to know what every detail means.
So even if you're ambiguous on
or ambiguous
on hat or covering, then hat covering, hair length, whatever. And tell me if I'm wrong, Lionel, but when I was translating it, it kind of felt like there was one word or two words that we did. And then all the rest of it hung on it, do you know?
So it's the word for the opposite of unveiling, covering or veiling. There's another word further down that means something like covering. On Mondays, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays, and probably Saturdays, I would go for the veil.
Really?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's what seems to me to be just on balance. And then on the other days that I haven't mentioned, I'd probably go that it has something to do with hair and tying up hair, but they're both connected together.
Right.
Sorry about
I mean, on Saturdays, I go for veil and all the rest of the week I'm on hair length. What about you, Denny?
Oh, look, I might sit smack bang in the middle. I've got my hair down today, so I probably should say veil. No, I'm just joking. But I do agree with Lionel that we can spend a lot of time, you know, getting into the depths of what is this he's talking about.
Yes.
Whereas I think what we need to keep going back is the principle that we see being unfolded through the text.
Yes.
And then thinking about how do we apply that within our own context 2,000 years later, where if we're not at a royal wedding, we don't tend to wear hats to church.
Yes.
You know,
that's it.
So
that
okay.
was quite funny, the royal wedding.
Yeah.
And the principle is for women to honour their husbands, at least, in what they do with their head, in terms of honour.
Just because we've only got 30 minutes, what I'd like to ask you to do is for each of you just to take the passage and kind of go on a riff as to what you think it means. Do you know? So I noticed myself, I just went and got the outline of when I preached on this a decade ago, and I thought there was a principle, there was an application of the principle, there were some supporting arguments, and then I talked about what it meant for today. Do you know? And so perhaps you could just... You go first, Denny. You know?
Why do you keep me putting me first on these things? Well, I'm not sure that I would disagree with what you said. I think there is a principle that we see, particularly in verse 3. I think we have to work hard at what that principle means.
So tell me, now I want you to fill it in for me.
I think the principle is that there, men and women have been created differently to relate to one another in a particular way that is some sense an echo of how the Godhead relates, that there is an appropriate way for that relationship to play out. And we see, I think, from other passages, particularly in the church and in the home, and that it's important for men and women to not try and be each other in the way they relate, and not try and look like each other, not try and upset that distinction that God has created, and that in this cultural context, the veil or the hair was a specific way in which that was actually shown. I think it means that we ought to make sure that we are men and women who embrace being men and women in the way that God's created us and relating to each other in that way. That's a very general run through,
Enjoy being a daughter of God.
Yeah, that's right. And enjoy the opportunities it gives you as a daughter of God to be like Jesus in the way that you relate.
Very similar. Maybe I'll probably end up repeating some things.
That's fine, yeah.
But what Paul is saying is that there is a key principle that these relationships between men and women in terms of honour in the way that we honour each other and this order is part of the gospel. And it's not part of the sin or the fall. That's verse 3. And I assume that's because people were saying that it was part of the fall or something, or you know, in some way not part of the gospel. And then what Paul says is, therefore, that needs to play out in the way that men and women relate, and particularly in terms of the way that women do something with their head that honours men.
Men also do something
women.
With their head.
That's,
I mean,
exactly.
They've got to...
They are to honour Christ and that relationship by not doing something with their head, which appears to have to do with hair, and There is something about the way that nature and the context in which we are in, because both of those are in some way from God. God brings about us as natural beings, but he also places us within a cultural setting where it means something to honour and dishonour. And yet both our nature, our sort of our physical nature as well as our culture, is also sinful. And so, you know, we need to just not say, well, because it's culture, it's okay. Because even in Paul's world, that wasn't the case. What is it? I'm not sure exactly. In terms of going through the passage, verse 9, I just want to point out verse 9. This is just a little aside, but I think it's important to say that it doesn't say that the man was that the woman was created for man's use, because that can be the way that it's often taken in our translation.
So I'm just reading the Holman, and man was not created for woman, but woman for man.
Woman for man. Now, that can be taken, and it's wrongly taken.
Some people have taken this.
To mean that the woman was created for the man's sake to use as he wants to use.
And therefore gone on a domestic violence riff.
Yeah.
Yes, or at least set up conditions under which domestic violence might happen or whatever it is. Mm. Now, the word, you've got to, if you're preaching on this, we're talking, talking to preachers, you've got to go back to the Greek.
What's the Greek say here?
It's the dia. The preposition dia plus the accusative doesn't mean for the use of, in terms of for. It means on account of. I think it's far more likely that it's saying that the woman was created on account of the man somehow. That is, makes most sense to me to say...
So what's the cash value of on account of?
On account of. It is not good for the man to be alone.
Ah, right. Okay.
So the woman was created on account of that reason.
The woman was created because the man needs her.
Needed
a helper.
And... as you go on, and verse 11 and 12, you also see that men need women. Women need men, men need women. And we need to honour one another in that. And the particular honour here is the women honouring the men, but we need to honour one another in that as well. So in verses 11 and 12, Paul deliberately, I think, and this is in terms of preaching as well, Paul deliberately appears to realise that what he is saying could be taken wrongly and could be taken in some way for men to think that they have some greater authority than they do, because he's just mentioned the word authority in verse 10. So what we need to do is, I think, preach that and preach what Paul is doing right here and saying this could be taken wrongly. And he deliberately turns around and says, no, this is not what it means. Verse 11 and 12. He's not pulling back from it. And then there's a conclusion about nature.
That's really helpful. I just got one last one, which is when I put it out on Facebook in a minister's group looking for these talks on 1 Corinthians 11. Mike Padgett down the road at Barney's, St. Barnabas Broadway, for those who are watching from other places than Sydney, he drew my attention to, have you seen the recent sermon conversation on 1 Timothy 2, 11 to 15, between Erica Hammonds and I at Barney's? They had a moment where they got to that passage in their exegetical preaching. Michael and the women's pastor at Barney's, Erica, both presented.
And she's the associate pastor.
Associate pastor at Barney's, Michael and Erica, the associate pastor at Barney's, both presented. She's identified in the presentation as an egalitarian, and he's identifying as a complementarian. And can I just ask, he's put it up as a thing for us to think about. What did you think?
I've had a look at the video. I had a chat to Mike as well. I gave him a call too. But look at the video. The first thing I want to say is that the video is actually, there's really two parts to it, and they are quite distinct. The first part is a discussion about 1 Timothy 2, and the second is an extended reflection by Erica on sexism and misogyny, really. And I think it is helpful for us to distinguish and separate the two. There's a connection, but really there are two different things. And we don't want to go along the line, I don't think they want us to go down the line, that your take on how you read 1 Timothy 2 is related to sexism. Now, I think that's really important. That testimony that Erica gave about sexism is very important for us to hear. It's very important for men to hear. It's very important for complementarian men to identify that way, to say, oh, everything's fine. No, not everything is not fine. We are sinners, and we will sin, and this is a way in which we sin, and we need to be very alert to the kind of the misogyny, the sexism that is often identified.
It's present in our society and in our churches.
And in our churches and in us. Mm. And it's a problem of sin that's very deep-seated. Mm. And the other thing that Erica said, which is really helpful, is that she has noticed this in egalitarian as much as complementarian churches. She's seen it in both, at least, egalitarian and complementarian churches. And she wanted to emphasise that. And I think that's very helpful for us to see that this problem is not a problem that is something that we can just simply solve by getting our structures right or by getting our ideology right or something. No, it's more deep-seated than that. It's a problem of sin, and we need to identify that wherever it is. And so that was very, very important, and I was glad that she said that and that she identified it's, it's not just a problem for complementarians.
Danny.
I think I want to say, first of all, that I was really encouraged to see an opportunity of men and women modelling a complementarian partnership in what was happening. Ironically, my understanding of 1 Timothy 2 would mean that I wouldn't feel comfortable doing that myself. But I actually do think that we need to do better in complementarian churches at actually giving opportunities for men and women to, in some sense, appropriately be talking with each other publicly about this. I think ultimately it really it's an echo of 1 Corinthians 11 in a sense. Lionel talked a bit earlier about going with the grain of the passage. Where we ended up in that conversation that Erica and Mike had was almost a complete reverse. Well, it was a complete reversal of the plain reading of the text.
In that the text says what, and they said what.
So the text says, "I do not permit a woman to teach." Erica, in her summation, said women ought to learn, which the text says, in order to teach. Now, to get there, we don't have time to go into it all, but it was the idea that actually Paul's concern here is that women were engaging in false teaching, so they ought not to be teaching until they've learnt the truth. I think when we look at 1 Timothy and 2 Timothy, I'm not at all convinced by that reading, because the people that Paul is constantly rebuking for false teaching in 1 and 2 Timothy as men. Mm-hmm. And I think if his concern in that passage was to say people ought to learn properly before they teach, he could have just said that rather than saying, I do not permit women to teach. But leaving that aside, that's a general statement. I think the implication that I was wondering about in this particular occasion was, because we ended up with a reversal of the plain reading of the text, without the presentation of a credible view that actually made sense of the plain reading of the text.
I thought it was disappointing that there was no one on the platform who said, I think the text means I do not permit a woman to teach or have authority over men.
Yeah, and I think the thing I'm thinking about whatever now as means, a result of that is, what does that mean for the person in the pew who wants to know that they can open God's word and read it confidently for themselves without needing to interpret it through the lens of all the historical things that may or may not have been happening at the time? I'm just a bit concerned about what that does to the confidence of the clarity of Scripture as we approach it and read it without needing to look right through the Scripture to assume cultural occasions that were happening that might completely change the meaning of the Scripture itself.
Lionel.
I've got some questions for Mike. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I have questions for Mike. I've asked him these questions.
You rang him up and had a chat.
I rang him up and had a chat about it. And I spoke at Barney's a few... Mike invited me to come and speak on just an overview of 1 Timothy a few months ago. So it's been good.
What were your questions?
Yeah. The two questions are, what I heard Mike saying was not precisely what I saw him modelling. It's not what I saw him modelling. It seemed like he was modelling the opposite of what he was saying. So I actually did hear him, and it was a little unclear because he wasn't actually spelling out exactly where he was, but it was a little unclear. But he does believe, and he was saying, that teaching and authority, that command is, yes, there's a specific situation, but it is a more general principle of male eldership, and male eldership expressed through teaching in some way. But I didn't see that being modelled in the actual presentation. So in the presentation, Mike deliberately said, I'm going to step down now so that Erica can have the final word and that kind of thing. It was a helpful final word in one sense, but Mike wasn't modelling that teaching and having authority that a male elder should do. He seemed reluctant to follow through. Now, Mike has said that there's an overall context to this, so you need to take into account the context of the structures of your church and who are the elders, and there's a relational structure and there's a kind of a structure. He said, you know, that he would do that in other ways. But I think the actual speech act that's going on there, especially if you're going to take that and almost isolate it and then send it out to the world on a video, that 1,000 more people are kind of probably going to watch that than are going to watch
the next week or
the week after, who knows what his I don't know, you know, who knows what his structures are necessarily. So that's the first one. And the second question is that the message that came across, that was repeated a number of times that Mike wanted to give, was we need to celebrate a diversity of interpretation. That is, different people have different views on this, and is it a secondary matter? Hard to know. But we need to celebrate the fact that people have a diversity of interpretation. Now, again,
I kind of think, we workshop together the meaning of the text, and we come to unity in the faith and in the knowledge of the Son of God. And I'm working on the theory that I may not have got yet to what God meant, but he did have a meaning, and I should be pursuing his meaning. And as I talk with you and you, well, I learn from you, you learn from me, we rub off against each other and we look at the text, and eventually, God willing, we might come to properly knowing the mind of God.
That's what we need. I chatted to Danny as well as we look at it. It's not that we celebrate diversity. In fact, diversity is a sign that
we're not yet there.
Yeah. That's right. Mm. So what we do is we use that. We don't stamp on everybody to say, well, you're different from me, and so, you know, I'm right or whatever. We need to have humility, but not celebrate diversity of interpretation. Mm. Again, I want to ask. I put this to Mike. And Mike said, actually, the next week, he spoke on 1 Timothy 3, and he spoke on the authority of God's word, and he was kind of going in that direction. Mm. And again, the remaining question that I have and had for Mike was, well, the problem is that this is an isolated, it's a one-off thing in one sense. Mm. And even if it's not a one-off thing, it's actually in the act of public, whatever it is, you know, public speech, whatever it was, a sermon or whatever it was, that you're modelling these things, and you can't necessarily just say, well, the rest of the context makes more sense.
We've gone over time.
What a surprise.
I want to say thanks so much to Dr. Lionel Windsor from Moore Theological College and Danny Truick, who've been my guests this afternoon on The Pastor's Heart. And we'll look forward to seeing you next Tuesday afternoon at 2, or to talking with you on the podcast in the catch-up later on. Thanks very much for being with us. Hey, if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, we would love it if you could hop over to the Apple Podcasts app and give us a rating and review. That helps us in the rankings and lets other people discover The Pastor's Heart. And again, if you are able to help us out by being a financial partner, go to our Patreon link, patreon.com/thepastorsheart.